Welcome to our first full episode of Spinnaker Trust From the Helm. I'm Tim Melissa, Director of Portfolio Management at Spinnaker Trust. And as always, I'm joined by our Chief Investment Officer, Jessamyn Norton, and Investment Director, Eben Joes. In this episode, we plan on recapping the choppy third quarter we saw in the equity markets and review our positioning, talk about China and U.S. trade relations, touch base on monetary and fiscal policy, give an update on equity fundamentals. This year has also been a very busy year for IPOs, and we review the IPO market, and finally, where we are in the business cycle. And also, we have some exciting news to share with you about Spinnaker Trust. So the third quarter has been was a really choppy one, which stands in contrast with the smooth sailing we saw in the equity markets during the first half of the year. Can you guys give us a recap on the volatile quarter starting in July?
Yeah, so for the first half of the year, equity markets were, you know, almost straight up, you know, on the easing news out of the Fed, as well as, I think, better expectations around trade. And that kind of went south over the summer. Equity markets peaked in July, and then trade kind of fell apart in August. And it's been on again, off again throughout. But really, in the third quarter, ended up being flat. There was obviously the Brexit news in and out of that, better, worse. There was a spike in oil after a Saudi Arabia plant was bombed, and then that died down. So there were quite a few things going back and forth. But really, the continuation of a slowing global growth continued throughout the quarter. Jessamyn, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I would say that fundamentals personified by earnings, I guess, had been slowing all year. And that was the case in the third quarter. So as Eben mentioned, everything was just choppy and news driven, largely on trade and with the Fed. We had language in January that the Fed didn't admit a hiking mistake in December, but basically walked that back. And so we fully expected Fed easing, so rate cutting, to begin starting in September, and that did happen. And it was just really, really choppy on news. Anytime you have a straight up first half, you know, I think your expectations have to be tempered for the periods thereafter. And by and large, earnings revisions have come down since the second quarter. So that fundamental side of things wasn't improving.
Yeah, and I feel like it's almost become even more sensitive, as you know, we saw in the second quarter, Germany and the UK posted negative GDP numbers. You know, a lot of investors are trying to guess what the Fed's going to do, how many cuts are going to actually happen, are they going to continue QE? And, you know, as these numbers continue to contract, obviously the risk of a recession is rising. So it's a lot of investors are more sensitive to the news releases.
So you guys talked about a lot of things right there. Obviously, you mentioned markets all-time high in July, big downturn in August. How are we positioning our equity portfolios at this time?
Oh, we have several strategies, but our core portfolios are all holding a bit of excess cash, and we put that cash on in December of last year as a hedge against increasing volatility. And, you know, in one sense, we've been right in that the fundamentals have clearly decelerated and been poor this year. But on the other hand, we were wrong in that the market really hasn't cared a whole lot. So we maintain that positioning. So with the cash aside, we have a pretty diversified portfolio. We don't have our foot all the way in the defensive camp, nor do we have it all the way in the cyclical camp. So I would say that we, you know, are barbelling it more or less. Within our ETF strategies, we have incrementally moved a little bit more cyclically over the last couple of months by emphasizing sectors like energy and financials and trimming some of the bond proxy sectors, which are, you know, very, very expensive with mass amounts of flows into them over the last year. So clearly that movement has been overdone if and only if we've seen the bottom in the macro data.
Eben, what about our positioning in fixed income? Where do we stand?
We've been very defensive all year. We've been above benchmark duration relative to the Barclays aggregate. We've been in investment grade corporates, U.S. treasuries primarily, some mortgage-backed securities. And then just to buttress that on the alternatives front, we've owned a position in gold start from the beginning of the year. So very defensively positioned.
So in this past quarter, a lot has happened between U.S. and China trade relations. Can you guys touch base as to what actually did happen in the past quarter and year to date and where we are now?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. So I guess a recap might be appropriate, as well as where we stand on trade relations really depends upon who you talk to. If you're following Trump's Twitter feed, you get one message. And if you're following news out of China, you get a different message. But to go back a little bit further, the trade talks were ongoing, and it seemed coming into the beginning of May that we were on the precipice of something big. And by big, I mean not just a big soybeans buy from the U.S., but an all-encompassing trade deal. And then at the last minute, sources say that China walked that back. You know, perhaps they, I'm not sure what the change of heart was, or perhaps they never really intended to go through with it. But that original deal that didn't go through had all-encompassing investment and enforcement type of mechanisms that have been so important to this administration. And so Trump retaliated by threatening new tariffs on October 1st. And so I think, I mean, that was a big catalyst for setting off a pretty robust pullback starting in May. So that's where we stood. And Trump was supposed to put the new tariffs on October 1st, but in a really conciliatory gesture, postponed them to October 15th, because October 1st was the 70th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. And, you know, it's like a really robust July 4th. They have a huge parade and, you know, big. It's very symbolic and important. So just in so doing, that seemed like a really big gesture when I read about it. And as of now, you know, that was a momentous thing, and it really took everything back to square one. But after that, the two sides started talking again, albeit at lower levels, not the highest level, trade negotiators. And at about a week ago, President Trump said that, you know, a great deal had been done. He called it phase one of a deal. But if you read Chinese media, they said that they were still negotiating. So we really don't know. But the first phase of the deal seems to have been an all-encompassing agreement to basically buy soybeans from the U.S. So it was kind of more of a farmer bailout, but it certainly did not touch upon all of the principles that the Trump administration has talked about. So on one hand, it's better. You know, Trump postponed the October 1st tariffs in what was a really nice gesture to the government, and they are talking, and they have agreed to one small provision in the deal. So it's better than it was 2 months ago, but you know, I don't think anyone would call it thorough, all-encompassing, or a big win by the U.S.
Yeah, I think one thing we do know, though, is that the U.S. economy is slowing and the presidential election is coming up for Trump. So, and, you know, there's issues in China as well. Their economy is slowing. There were issues around food price inflation in China causing some problems. So I think there is a, you know, they're getting to a point where it's like, okay, we do need to start doing something.
I disagree on that. The Chinese economy has been slowing for years, and that's intentional. The government's been slowing it down. Coming out of the 2015 and 2016 market and kind of economic correction, which was the last little mini cycle that we saw within this bigger cycle, there was a huge black market in lending. And the Chinese government got scared. They wanted to rein that in a little bit, so they really cut off credit. And they also have been very open over the last decade about shifting from an export-led economy to a consumer-led economy. And so this was all part of the master plan. The Chinese economy has been slowing somewhat as part of the global business cycle, but more importantly, I think, intentionally by them. But as Eben pointed out, for the first time in a while, inflation is going up there. Pork prices are up, I think, more than 60% because they had an epidemic. And that's the big staple of diets over there. So that's a big deal. And the GDP just came out at 6% for the third quarter this morning. We all know that GDP number is basically made up. But nevertheless, the trend is worth following. And so the trend is slower. And that's the slowest we've seen in modern times, I think. So there could be something to it. And also, you know, who are they going to face? Are they going to face Elizabeth Warren? Are they going to face the enemy they already know, who is Donald Trump? You know, I'm sure there's a lot of calculation happening in Beijing also.
So obviously there's been protests in Hong Kong regarding Hong Kong-China relations. Can you touch base on that briefly, maybe give a little brief history on it too?
Yeah, I'll start on that. So when the British handed over Hong Kong to the Chinese, there was a kind of a time period around when Hong Kong would transition toward China from a political perspective. And That time is growing closer. The catalyst for all of this was an extradition bill that came into Hong Kong. And then the protests started at that point, and they've grown exponentially, I think, much more than anybody could have ever realized. And there's all sorts of rumors that the Chinese government has troops on the border ready to go. You know, in the beginning, the protests were they were well attended. There were millions of people in the streets, but they were very calm and orderly. And then in the last 2 months or so, they've taken a much more violent turn. So, you know, it's interesting. I think China sees Hong Kong as being very important as well as Taiwan and their perceived control over those two areas. And so I think the Chinese government is well aware of how it looks in the world, you know, how everybody is viewing this. And they're certainly trying to suppress news about Hong Kong within the country, and that's for sure. So, the Hong Kong market has been horrible, which of course is a subset of Asia. But this is just a really important political test and the first real uprising we've seen against China that we're aware of. Or, I mean, I guess since Tiananmen Square, right? But in the last 10 or 15 years. And the stuff with the MBA, I mean, all of this for markets, all of this means that the relationship with the U.S. and with developed countries is just much more tense than it had been. It adds a new element to the trade talks.
So switching gears a little bit, let's do a monetary and fiscal policy recap. Why is the Federal Reserve cutting rates after raising rates 9 times since 2015?
It just appears they raised rates too far. Growth did start to slow. There were signs of this. They immediately turned around and said, okay, we can't raise rates anymore, and we're actually going to think about lowering rates. And that commenced in July. You know, the market thinks that they're going to continue to cut rates. You know, they have been correct in needing to take out this kind of insurance policy a la 95, I think was when they did the same kind of routine. As, you know, the manufacturing sector in the U.S. has slowed considerably. Meanwhile, there's the other side of the argument, where while they're doing this, the U.S. economy appears to be in good shape. When you look at the unemployment rate, inflation is low, but it's, you know, core inflation is actually right around 2, which is the Fed's target. So there is this tension a little bit while you're cutting rates when you have very low unemployment and wage inflation around 3%. So it was necessary. We'll see how far it continues.
No, I don't know if it was necessary. Eben and I talk a lot about it was necessary from a sentiment perspective. Eben and I talk a lot about how there doesn't seem to be any business growth or investment that's been constrained by the really low interest rates that we've had, whether that was a year ago, which while rates had risen, it was still low on a relative basis, versus now, where now it's 0.5% lower than it was at the peak and probably will be 0.75 at the end of this month. It's interesting, and it's a little scary in that the Fed just won't have as much ammo going into the next recession. So whether that's next year or not for another few years, you know, starting at the 1.5% Fed funds level, you know, historically in past recessions, the Federal Reserve has cut 500 basis points or 5%. And, you know, if you assume that the zero bound is where we'll stop, they really don't have a lot of runway in front of them. So it's a gamble. It's clearly throwing the long term under the bus for the benefit of the short term. So we'll see. And as Eben points out, core inflation was 2.4% last month. And so that's over the core inflation. You know, there's a chance that the Fed won't cut in October. And if that happens, we'll see a nice big pullback, is my guess.
And obviously the Fed is under incredible political pressure to continue cutting rates.
Yes.
Although they remain
they wouldn't admit
neutral,
to it.
Independent on that.
So what are the fixed income markets telling us in terms of number of cuts upcoming potentially and the yield curve?
Yeah, so the yield curve, if you look at the 3 month and the 10-year, was inverted quite a bit. I think it hit negative 49 basis points in August. And typically when that's inverted for 3 or 4 months like it was, that is an indicator of a recession to come over the near term. You know, it is since actually uninverted, which is typical because before a recession, actually, because you have a bull steepener where short end rates come down. So that's happened, one, because the Fed has cut rates twice, but also expectations on how much they're going to cut have come up. So they've kind of met a little bit in the middle. The 10-year, meanwhile, has stayed roughly around the same positioning. But I definitely think the shape isn't saying that, oh, hey, we're not going to go towards a recession. So far, the movement has showed that the 10-year has not risen, as it would if growth expectations had come up.
It's come up a little bit. The 10-year's up from the bottom, which was right about 1.4% this summer. So I think we're at 1.75. Yeah. So that's a reasonable move, but nobody would call that robust.
It's been extremely volatile. Yeah, it went from 1.4 to 1.9. It's now back around 1.75 today. So it's moving quite a bit, which I think just goes to show you that folks don't know which way it's going to go from here.
No, I mean, I think if there is no recession and everything improves and fiscal and monetary policy are effective in 2020, then the 10-year should be higher than it is now. If the opposite is true and, we're about to hit a major slowdown, then we should probably be closer to 1.2 or something. So I feel like the 10-year is hedged right in the middle right now.
It is, yeah. That's that feeling.
So we're right in the middle of third quarter corporate earnings. The big banks just reported this past week. What fueled the corporate earnings in 2018? And Jessamyn, you mentioned earlier that 2019 earnings haven't been as great. What's causing that?
So to recap and go back and just speak broadly about 2018, we had the benefit of the Trump tax cuts, which I believe were implemented or passed on the last day of 2017. So we had a full year of comparisons where companies had tremendous tax cuts, but they also had the ability to repatriate cash from overseas at a very low tax rate. And that was a really big deal for several sectors, most primarily tech. And so we saw that cash put to work in retiring debt, but mostly buying back shares, a little bit of M&A. But, whenever you for all you financial wonks out there in your models, whenever you cut your corporate tax rate from 28 to 21, your earnings and your share price go up a lot. So that was it. And trade was in a reasonable place. Trade was in a reasonable place, and global growth was faster than it is today. So there was some fundamental backstop for that as well. So it was almost like the perfect positive storm. So you had positive fundamentals and then this trade issue layered on. This year, of course, even going into it without having known how trade would evolve, you knew you had tough comps. That's one of the analyst lessons, that you just see what the comparisons look like from a year-on-year perspective. Those were going to be difficult. We also had the U.S. dollar rising. It hasn't spiked, but I believe, at the highest point, it was up 4 or 5% on a year-over-year basis. It's now down to 2 or 3%, so that's helpful. And you also just had PMI slowing down. You had global growth slowing down, and that hurts the U.S. markets because we are a very multinational market. So we've just had a slowdown broadly. The question is this coming to an end, or is it going to, our trade and other issues going to compound the problem? And so we don't know yet. The fundamentals, we usually get a monthly update on this stuff, and they, as of now, they are deteriorating still. And I should mention that this earnings season, so for the third quarter, going into it, analysts had expected earnings to be down 3 or 4% on a year-over-year basis. They had also expected earnings to be negative in the second quarter, and that didn't pan out. I believe the actual earnings growth was 1% or 2%. But psychologically, being a little bit, growing a little bit versus contracting a little bit is a big deal. Overall, the estimates for the full year of 2019 are, anywhere from flat, so 0% growth to 2% growth. So we'll see how it comes in.
Yeah, we're early in earnings season right now, but we have had a lot of the banks report, and they're definitely seeing an uptick in what you would expect with lower rates, right? Mortgages, strong consumer, auto loans, credit quality has remained really strong. So far, so good on third quarter earnings, but we'll see.
It's early days.
Very
early. We're probably only 15% of the way in. So there's a lot that can happen over the next few weeks.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to touch base on the IPO market and where we are in the business cycle.
So we're really excited to announce that Spinnaker Trust was named one of the best places to work in Maine. And we were in the small company category, which is for companies that have 50 and fewer employees. This is the first year that we've done this, and we got feedback from every single person at our company. Of course, because we did well, our feedback was pretty good, but we got some opportunities to learn about things that we could do better. And overall, I think it's just a testament to how strong our culture is and how much we enjoy working together. So we're really excited about that, and we'll continue to do it in future years. We'll keep you posted.
So we've had several high-profile initial public offerings over the last year. Uber, Lyft, Pinterest, Peloton, to name a few. What does this usually suggest?
Typically, it would suggest late cycle. These companies want to go public. They want to give their employees a chance to monetize their shares. They want to get additional funding before those doors possibly close. So like you said, a lot of these companies have come public and the result has not been good. They don't make any money. They don't have clear paths to making money. They're obviously very interesting, intriguing ideas. They could be huge, but investors have been very critical of them coming out. And maybe that's partially because they maybe stayed private too long. They continue to raise money at a higher and higher valuation. And those valuations just don't stand up when you have to be a when you're a public company and you have to disclose everything.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. We've been waiting for this wave of IPOs. They all seem to have been delayed. You know, Uber was the big one that kicked it off. That's a name brand. And I mean, this is the first year that we've had, you know, we could speak about this forever, and Eben is our venture expert, but I would say there's a full-blown bubble in venture capital, and none of these companies had ever heard anything critical about their path, whether that be to profitability or growth. You know, venture investors continue to fund and provide liquidity and hope that these companies continue to take market share above all else. So there hadn't been emphasis on improving margins or even having earnings. And the public markets, depending upon the environment, care very much about the growth of earnings and things of that nature. You know, they've been, and they're also all dressed up as tech companies. Now, some of these IPOs are legitimately tech companies. Is Uber a tech company because it has a really well thought out app, or is it a taxi company? Is Peloton a tech company, or do I just put my iPad on my spin bike? You know, it's interesting. And clearly, as Eben said, it's late cycle. These companies have just been going and going. They could have stayed private. They could have continued to get venture funding, most likely. And one of the new things that we've had in this cycle that never happened before is because venture has been such a destination over the last 10 years, and we've seen such an emphasis on technology, is that investors who before could not have access to this world, so some of the big mutual fund companies, you know, the growth funds at Fidelity and T. Rowe Price and others have taken stakes in these companies and had them for some time. So that's a new element. But these are also, you know, in the past, these would have been the new and incremental buyers of these IPOs. They were already there. So it's been very interesting to follow. It's clearly late cycle. And it makes me a little happy in that it brings some rationality back to markets. You know, some of these ideas had felt downright irrational for a while. So, you know, I'm happy that a WeWork that has no plan, you know, and is really just a REIT, a dressed up REIT, doesn't do well in markets. It didn't deserve to. It wasn't well thought out, and it had this crazy concept and community adjusted EBITDA. You know, that's a joke. So I'm happy that the market is a little more rational.
Yeah, there's also been this issue of controlling shares that hasn't gone over very well with public investors. You know, especially the WeWork example is a good one. The CEO, I don't know, flamboyant, maybe is how you describe him.
He was on the cover of the New York Post with bare feet in Tribeca just 2 weeks
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, and he has controlling share of the company and he's not going to give it up via the IPO. That's going to be a problem for investors.
Yeah. No, you would point out that both Facebook and Google, you know, Google's been public for a really long time, but have a similar share structure, but have come under a considerable amount of criticism over the years for that. It's very well known. And it's worth noting that the S&P indices have decided that they're not going to include within their indices companies that have split share classes like that. So the companies that are already there are grandfathered in. So that premise loses a little bit of its bite. But on a go-forward basis, you know, that's incentive to drop that kind of share structure.
So finishing up here, guys, where are we in the business cycle? You mentioned, you know, this IPOs. Activity is potentially late cycle. So where are we?
I think you have to believe that we are late cycle I think part of the problem is, though, we've had a lot of mini cycles throughout this, and we've talked about this in the past. And part of that is the Federal Reserve is really supporting these mini cycles. They've really been there each and every time to catch the market. And they appear to be doing that again. So while we're late cycle, I think we believe that there we could go into, you know, rather than contract into a recession, there may be more slow growth ahead.
Yeah, I also believe that we are late cycle, and that's really for two reasons. We've had a full and notable yield curve inversion. It wasn't inverted for a day or two. It was inverted for 3 or 4 months consecutively. And we had a full rate cycle. We started hiking rates in 2015, and then we started cutting them this year. That is late cycle, no doubt. But, you know, late cycle can mean an imminent recession, or it can mean a recession within 24 months. So unfortunately, that's really difficult for investors. And Eben mentioned these mini cycles with the Fed as the backstop, and that's true. But China's been the catalyst for a lot of these mini cycles as well. You know, China is the engine of global growth for emerging markets in Europe and Japan. And so that importance can't be underestimated. And they've, you know, they basically go boom and bust. They stimulate the economy and then they have some bubbles internally and they rein it back in. And then they do that again. Those cycles have been on average 3 years long with an 18-month up ramp and an 18-month down ramp. So, you know, it's possible, as Eben mentioned, that we're at the bottom of one of those 18-month down ramps. The Chinese economy has been subtly stimulating its economy, not in the ways that it has in the past. And some would argue that this really hasn't been effective yet, and probably has not. It hasn't shown in the data. So we may have another mini cycle ahead of us before this is ultimately over. And as Eben mentioned, thanks to fiscal, but also mostly monetary policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Spinnaker Trust from the Helm. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast and feel free to give us a 5-star rating on Apple iTunes. Enjoy the fall. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.